Joseph McBride is joining us now from California, film historian, biographer, screenwriter, author, educator. He teaches at San Francisco State University, and he has been with us a few times on different matters. And for almost 40 years, his passion, beyond everything else he does, has been following the trail of the assassin, whoever killed John Fitzgerald Kennedy on November 22, 1963. 56 years ago today, on Friday, 12:35 Central Time, the shots rang out in Dealey Plaza. And all these years later, we really don't know if Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone or at all. Many people believe he did do it. And, of course, Vincent Bugliosi wrote a book that exceeded 1,000 pages, stating the case that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin. And Joseph McBride has been with us to rebut that. He believes otherwise. And in the last year, there was hope that new information would be revealed. There is information that the government has that has not been made available to the general public. Joseph McBride, where do we stand right now, 56 years post-assassination?
Well, hi. Thanks for having me on again. And I always feel somber and moved on this day, the anniversary of the terrible event. Well, you make an excellent point. There was the JFK Records Collection Act of 1992 was supposed to release all the previously declassified records in the government files. There were 5 million of them, and millions of documents and pages have come out, which is astonishing that it took a long time for them to come out. But in 2017, everything was supposed to be released, and the only exception was if the president of the United States at the time withheld something, and President Trump announced that he was going to release everything. And shortly before the deadline, the CIA and the FBI got to him, and they got him to block certain documents. So there thousands of documents are still partly redacted or blocked, which is astonishing if a lone nut with no known motive that they could figure out shot the president with a cheap mail order rifle from behind. Why are documents still being kept from us, the taxpayers, if there's no national security involved? So obviously the government is protecting things, and it's a scandalous state of affairs. Trump pushed it back to 2021, so that offers some hope, but they keep doing that, and here we are 56 years later, and we still don't have all the records. We do have an awful lot, though, and I've been researching this case steadily since it happened, but very seriously since the early 80s, and I talked to Penn Jones Jr., who was a Texas newspaper man who was an independent thinker, and I asked him in the 80s if we would ever solve the case, and he said...
Okay, hold tight. We're going to get more from Joseph McBride after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we're joined by Joseph McBride, primary historian for the Kennedy assassination. He's been with us a few times before, talking about what happened on this date 56 years ago in Dallas, Dealey Plaza. President Kennedy, 46 years old, assassinated. And America, of course, has been absorbing this ever since and trying to figure out what happened. Some people believe the case is closed. Others, like Joseph McBride, say a lot of questions remain to be answered. Certainly many documents that are available to the government have not been presented to the American people. And Joseph, when we talked with him briefly in the other segment, said that President Trump opted not to release documents that were slated for public viewing in 2017, pushing it back to 2021. And you were talking about a conversation with Penn Jones when we had to break, yeah. Joseph, what was that related to?
Yeah, he was an independent newspaper man at a little newspaper outside of Dallas, and he was on the case very quickly and did a lot of groundbreaking research. Anyway, when I started researching my book on the case, which is called Into the Nightmare, early 80s, I asked Penn, will the case ever be solved? And he said, well, I think I and a few friends solved it back in the 60s. And I think essentially we've known the broad outlines that Kennedy was killed by a crossfire, probably four gunmen, or three or four gunmen, or some people even say more, in Dealey Plaza. It couldn't have been one person. The doctors who operated on him tried to save his life, said he was shot in the throat from the front. They said that that afternoon, and he was hit on the side of the head, and that there's an FBI document that a bullet was being retrieved at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and that was never entered into evidence, and that destroys the Warren report right there, because they said they didn't find any bullets at the autopsy, and there's all kinds of problems with the so-called evidence, as Oswald called it. But I think of Mark Lane, who was another early researcher, said in 2013 that the honor of France was restored when they admitted that Captain Dreyfus was innocent, and he was the Jewish officer who was falsely accused of treason. And Lane said the honor of the United States will not be restored until we admit that Lee Harvey Oswald was innocent.
877-217-5757 is your number. Dan, downtown Baton Rouge. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Joseph McBride.
Yeah, good morning. In the Economist obituary on the Parkland surgeon, Robert McClellan, just a couple of months ago, it says in there that that there was no postmortem in Texas against state law.
Yeah.
When the doctor went to the archives, he saw that the exit wound had been covered up and that a colleague in trauma room one was sworn to silence.
Yeah, well, Dr. McClellan was an honest doctor. All the doctors and nurses at Parkland Hospital said the same thing, essentially, which was that there was a large wound in the back of Kennedy's head. His brains were blown out of his head. And that wound was not seen at Bethesda, where they did the autopsy. The body had been reconstructed. It sounds far-fetched, but it was true. They had a pre-autopsy autopsy in which the wound was expanded and made very large. And That's one of the problems for the case, is a lot of the evidence has been destroyed or altered. And so we have to go with eyewitness reports and documents, you know, like Secret Service men and eyewitnesses who were civilians, who were the real heroes of the case, saw Kennedy hit in the right temple by a bullet, for example. One thing I find that it's very inspiring, I teach at San Francisco State, and I taught a class yesterday on the assassination, which I do every year, and young people are willing to listen. My generation of baby boomers is more uptight about it, and you know, for a long time people didn't want to hear about it, and you still get pushback from some people. Some of my friends even say, well, why do you care about this case? It's not a contemporary issue. And I say, well, it is a contemporary issue. It affects the world we live in, and why do we have these endless wars, etc.? We had a military coup d'etat in 1963, and it's still in force because they haven't punished the people who killed the president at high noon, you know, on a public street, which is quite shocking. But a lot of people are in denial about that. However, about 70% of the public consistently has said they don't believe the official story of a lone gunman.
877-217-5757. There is still time to get in with Joseph McBride. He is a man who is an immense historian of various topics. He is the authority of note, for example, on Orson Welles, but his passion for almost 40 years has revolved around the Kennedy assassination, and we really don't know what happened. We may think we know what happened on November 22, 1963, and the question for many is, will we ever really know? Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on the air with Joseph McBride. Hi, Randy.
Yes, I just want to make a comment that the whole thing with the motorcade, that it often been said it would have been helpful if Kennedy would have had that bubble top. That way he couldn't have got a clear shot.
Would the bubble top have saved his life?
Unfortunately, it was a plastic top, and it might have deflected the shots or confused the aim of a gunman, but it was not bulletproof, but it would have possibly helped. And Bill Moyers, of all people, was the guy who gave the order. He testified under oath that he said, take it off the car at Love Field in Dallas. Moyers was an advance man on the trip, and it had been raining that morning, and they took the bubble top off. So Kennedy was unprotected, and the car came to a virtual stop. I talked to Senator Ralph Yarborough, who was in the car with Lyndon Johnson, and he said he told me quite a different story from what you see in the Zapruder film, which has also been altered. The car came to a, more or less a stop, and Secret Servicemen were jumping out of the car, swarming around the car. He thought there was an explosion in the car. And so, you know, we don't have all the pristine information, but we have an awful lot. I think we know pretty much what happened. We don't know who the shooters were, and we may never know that, but I think we know why. And for a long time, I resisted the obvious, which I think is that President Johnson was part of this plot with the military and the CIA, and the, Oswald was actually an FBI informant, and I interviewed Henry Wade, who was the DA in Dallas, gave me a remarkable interview. He said Oswald had talked to the FBI in Dallas the day before the assassination, which was news, and I said, the day before? And he said, well, a day or two before. And he had talked to them three times in the a couple weeks before. He was passing along information, not realizing he was being set up as the fall guy for the plot.
In 2013, our guest Joseph McBride published Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit. 877-217-5757. Dave in New Orleans. Dave, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Joseph McBride.
Hey, Jim. How you doing? Hi. Hey, Joseph McBride. How you doing?
Hi, Dave.
I can't even believe what I just heard. I mean, so McBride is now saying that LBJ was somehow conspiring with the CIA and FBI as part of this plot. I mean, here's the problem with the assassination and everybody that continues to basically throw this stuff out there. The only people who basically lend an ear or talk to people like Joseph McBride are the people who believe in this crazy conspiracy.
All right. Well, there are many people who have pointed a finger at the 36th American president. I personally don't believe Lyndon Johnson was involved, but obviously Joseph McBride and others do. Why would LBJ do something like this? At the risk, if nothing else, that it would have to involve a vast conspiracy, somebody might talk.
Well, I believed, you know, for a long time, I resisted the idea that LBJ could be involved. I was kind of like Dave. I would get upset about hearing this. It seemed like too upsetting. But the more I study the case, it's quite obvious. I mean, he ran the cover-up, for one thing. I mean, the Warren Commission is actually called the President's Commission on the Assassination of President Kennedy, and they covered up the case. And he had the authority. He was commander-in-chief. He had the authority over the autopsy and the evidence and the investigation.
Okay, but wouldn't there be other reasons to cover it up beyond personal involvement, perhaps to save the country?
Well, yes. I mean, one theory is that if you really thought a foreign power did it, which some people allegedly worried about the Russians or the Cubans doing it, which in neither case was true, covering it up, a benign conspiracy, they call it. Earl Warren may have been persuaded of that. But that's not a very good reason to cover up a major crime like that, especially after all these years. I mean, okay, if they did that in 1963, why are they still covering it up? But the evidence, there is a lot of evidence about Johnson having foreknowledge. I talked to Senator Yarbrough, for example, who said that Johnson was extremely tense and nervous in the car. And what he was worried about that day, there was a hearing going on in the Senate in which a guy was giving evidence, Don Reynolds, about bribery, that he had been forced to give a bribe to Johnson. And the walls were closing in on LBJ, and he was going to be thrown off the ticket. He might have even gone to jail. And Life magazine was doing a major investigation of his very crooked finances.
All right, hold tight. We've got some people we want to get in before we part company with Joseph McBride, Patrick in Innisfil. Patrick, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, your guest talks about Mark Lane. He does realize that's the lawyer that represented Jim Jones, said he wasn't holding people in Guyana against their will, and yet he was there the day they all committed suicide. Also, you say there's no evidence, there's no information. You think there's some secret file that the FBI's hiding? There's plenty of evidence on the Internet. We got x-rays, we got photographs, we got witness testimony. We have Oswald's biography himself, a sharpshooter, communist, lives in Russia for 2 years. Plus, we have the witnesses that were there, their testimony from that day. I'm not talking about witnesses that were never there who claim they were there.
All right. How do you respond to Patrick?
Well, he brought up a lot of things. Oswald's biography is too pat, as Nicholas Katzenbach, the deputy attorney general, himself said that weekend. It sounds too pat to say he was a communist who had defected to Russia. He was in the CIA's false defector program. He went to Russia to spy on the Soviet Union. They realized that he was not trustworthy, and they he came back. So a lot of what Oswald told his brother the night of the assassination when he visited him in jail, he said, don't believe this so-called evidence. That's what I would say to your caller. There's a lot of stuff that he thinks is true that isn't true. And
all right, hold tight. 877-217-5757. We're back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana as we head down the stretch. Alonda Villarreal is producing today along with Matt Doyle and Kirby Ferries, and your number is 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Joseph McBride, historian who, as you can hear, has come to the conclusion that President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was killed on this date 56 years ago on a Friday in Dallas by a vast conspiracy. His book, published in 2013, Into the Nightmare, was a culmination of more than 30 years of investigating. He continues to do that. And through the years, we have had people on this program talking about the Kennedy assassination. And I think on three occasions before he died, we had Vincent Bugliosi, who came to a totally different conclusion. And of all the people I've talked to in 40 years about the Kennedy assassination, Bugliosi and McBride are probably the two most pronounced as far as their knowledge. Now, you came to totally different conclusions. How do you explain that, Joseph?
Well, that's fascinating. I'm very skeptical about evidence, and this case taught me to not take anything at face value. I was somewhat naive when I was a kid, and I worked as a volunteer for Kennedy in the Wisconsin primary in 1960 and met him three times, and I actually was worried about his security, and I wrote a short story about his assassination in 1961, 2 years before it happened. And so I wasn't totally surprised because I saw him up close and how vulnerable he was. But, I've learned to be skeptical and examine every piece of evidence. That's what I would say to some of your guests who were astonished that people would question the official story. Just look at the evidence. Look at the documents. Read as many books as possible. Sylvia Marr's book, Accessories After the Fact, I would recommend to anybody. It's a deconstruction of the Warren Report, very meticulous, very fact-based. You know, she just goes through the report in the 26 supporting volumes and tears it apart.
Well, one of the most telling things is that on that date, when the last shot, the headshot rang out, people who were there looked the other way. They did not look toward the school book depository, and the belief by most people there was that the shots came from the so-called grassy knoll. We've got a few more minutes with Joseph McBride. Please be brief. Hampton and Baton Rouge. Hampton, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Yes, Jim. Thank you for this show. And I'd like to know what your guest thinks about R. McClellan's book, Blood, Money, and Power.
He was on this show many years ago. Now, he is one, Barr McClellan, who believes that Lyndon Johnson was involved.
Well, I think the book is very thin in terms of it doesn't really provide the evidence. I really believe that if you're going to make an argument about anything, you have to support the evidence. And you can't just sort of say, I heard this and I heard that, and I'm afraid he does that. There hasn't been a really good book on Johnson. It's a complicated thing to address, and one of your guests brought it up, and it was a good question, but I can't go, there's not enough time to go into LBJ. But Johnson, for example, 2 days after the assassination, reversed Kennedy's order to start withdrawing from Vietnam. Kennedy had started withdrawing troops, and 2 days later, Johnson secretly reversed it. That's why we had the Vietnam War.
Last question for our guest, Joseph McBride, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on the air. Please be brief, Phil.
Yes. The Warren Report, it seems to me, was incomplete, and I understand that there are many, many witnesses who were not interviewed, and a lot of them died under mysterious circumstances. Is there something to that?
Yes. Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of brave people came forward, and some of them paid with their lives. For example, Aquilla Clemens was an African-American woman who was half a block away from the Tippit murder, Officer Tippit. I studied that in great detail. Nobody had really investigated that properly until I decided to do it. She said she saw two men involved who were running in different directions after the shooting, and not Oswald. And she disappeared after giving an interview to Emil D'Antonio and Mark Lane for Rush to Judgment. You can see that interview on YouTube. It's very, she's a very honest person, and that happened to a fair number of people. People were shot at or shot or had mysterious accidents, and a lot of people bravely came forward. They're the heroes of the case, and I dedicate my book to her and some other people who've done that, and some of them are still alive, and some of the perpetrators are still alive, too. So it's a contemporary issue, as I tell my friends. We wouldn't be in all these endless wars and have this loss of faith in our government, loss of faith in the media, except for this case.
Joseph McBride, it's always a pleasure. He's the author of Into the Nightmare, still available. And, of course, we'll be calling on you, and hopefully, as the years go by, we'll find out more. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim. I really appreciate your interest. Thank you so much.
Good to talk with you.
Great. Bye.
And we're about to be joined by the bass player for the Iguanas, formed 30 years ago in New Orleans. Great group from Louisiana. They'll be on stage December 5th at the Dyson House here in Baton Rouge on Perkins Road. And for those who remember 1994, 25 years ago, their signature song was a big part of the fabric of our community. And you'll hear that, I'm sure, along with many other selections from the Iguanas. They've been around 30 years, and from the start, this gentleman has been part of the team. Rene Coleman, good morning to you.
Morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on, man.
How do you explain the longevity, the staying power for the Iguanas?
Well, I would say, you know, the fact that we still get along with each other, and, you know, we have a lot of common musical, you know, touchstones. Rapport, I guess, would be the short answer. And well, kindness.
Yeah. Well, you've been around for three decades, and it all started in New Orleans. How did you get together?
So the two singers actually knew each other in Fort Collins, Colorado. They had both moved there from, you know, one of them from Nebraska, the other one's from the North Bay, you know, Sebastopol, California. And they ran into the Subdudes, who were a New Orleans band but living in Fort Collins. They became friends. The Subdudes said, you know, you guys should move to New Orleans. You'd really like it. So they did, and then they started the band here in New Orleans. And I became aware of the band just as you know, I was a musician working in town. Went to see them a few times, wound up sitting in with them, and that was a month later I was in the band, and that was kind of the crystallization of the original lineup of the band. Happened in like December of 1990 is when I got in the band.
Well, yeah, you came a year later, but 29 years for Rene Coleman, the bass player, and it's it's rare to... You know, there aren't many groups like the Rolling Stones where you have people together for so long. What's been the secret to doing that?
Well, you know, as I said, kindness and patience. But at this point, when you're with people for so long, doing something so intimate like playing music, it becomes telepathic at a certain point. Mm-hmm. Once you get that level of rapport and telepathy, it's intoxicating because you think, well, you know, I play with all kind of other players, great musicians in all these different groups. That's all wonderful. You get back with a band like the Iguanas where you have so much history, so many connections. It's such a delicious experience. You think, well, I don't have enough time on the timeline to develop this with anyone else. You know, this is it's a precious thing. And I think, you know, that's, like the Stones, that's a perfect example of like band alchemy. You know, people that it works because it works. How it might not work on paper, it works in the real world. And the Iguanas is one of those bands that, you know, it's a perfect balance of personalities and influences.
You have a podcast as well.
I do. The Troubled Men podcast. I do it with my partner, Manny Chevrolet. He's a perennial candidate for mayor in New Orleans. He's a loose cannon. He's a wild card. But we've just recorded our 83rd episode last night. Our previous guests are like Susan Cowsill or the great Johnny Vodakovich, the dean of New Orleans drummers. But yeah, you know, New Orleans is so rich in talent, and you know, to get on the Troubled Men podcast, you can't just be talented. You have to be talented and have some kind of kinky other element in it. But fortunately, New Orleans is filled with those people as well.
The Troubled Men, that's the podcast.
Troubled Men, yes. Troubled Men podcast. Yeah, check it out.
From Renee Coleman. And you can see and hear Renee December 5th, not that far away, 13 days away, two Thursdays,
yes.
At the Dyson House, which, of course, is Zeeland Market by day, Dyson House by night. And the act preceding the Iguanas will be Rachel Ammon, who is an exceptional performer from Arkansas. I saw her not so long ago, and she brought down the house in Little Rock. So it should be quite an evening with Renee Coleman, the Iguanas, and Rachel Ammon. And thank you. Congratulations on three decades of continuing success for the Iguanas. Good to talk with you, Renee.
Thank you, Jim.
And the Troubled Men podcast. You can find out much more about what Renee is doing. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. Until Monday, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.